Good afternoon. My name is Jeffrey Myron. I'm the Vice President for Research at Cato. I want to thank you all for coming. Thank Ryan for organizing this conference. Thanks Searle Foundation for its financial support. And especially thank all the Cato conference and media people who make events like this run as well-oiled machines. It's now my privilege to introduce our lunch speaker, Jason Furman. Jason is the Edna Professor of the Practice of Economic Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School and in the Department of Economics in the Faculty of Arts and Sciences. Jason engages in public policy in a wide range of areas, including US and international macro, fiscal policy, labor markets, and competition policy. He also co-teaches Ec 10, the Introductory Principle of Economics course, which is the largest course at Harvard. Previously, Jason served 8 years as a top advisor to President Obama, including serving as the 28th chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors. He's a member of numerous organizations, including the Council of Foreign Relations, the Group of 30, serves as the trustee or on the advisory board of other prestigious organizations such as Russell Sage, the Brookings Papers, and the Hamilton Project. In addition to articles in scholarly journals, Jason regularly contributes to the Wall Street Journal and Project Syndicate, including in this morning's Wall Street Journal. He earned his BA from Harvard, where he was first-year roommates with Matt Damon. I don't think we'll hear much about that today. And he holds his PhD in economics from Harvard as well. Now, beyond the impressive credentials, what I want to emphasize about Jason is that when I come across one of his op-eds, I can often predict what his position is going to be, but not consistently, not always, because he doesn't endorse a particular party line of either party. Similarly, when I do disagree, which happens, okay, it's not about values or adherence to the red team or blue team, but it's about economics. Reasonable economists can and do disagree with decent frequency, and that's presumably healthy for everyone. This sort of open-minded perspective, this thoughtful perspective, is pretty unusual, to say the least. Jason's perspective suggests someone who cares about getting it right and not just signaling loyalty to a particular tribe. And I, for one, am truly appreciative of that. So without further delay, I'm delighted to welcome Jason. Thank you very much.
And I'm truly appreciative of that kind and generous introduction. I'm also appreciative that somebody's invited me to talk about a topic other than inflation. I used to have a wide range of topics I'd thought and worked about and have gotten overly obsessed with that one narrow one. Perhaps taking off of Jeff's introduction and that way of thinking, I wanted to start by talking about one of the big problems in public policy is that we don't just have one objective. We often have many objectives, and the objectives we have may differ depending on our values. One objective would be to raise as many people's incomes as much as possible. We also care about people's lives, protecting their lives in a pandemic, extending them and letting them live longer and healthier lives. We might care about climate change. We might care about poverty. We might care about inequality. There's many objectives that could show up on that list. When thinking about how to make policy with those different objectives, I think there's a sort of classic mistake that's more common among liberals and a classic mistake that's more common among conservatives. And I'm going to caricature both of these mistakes. And of course, these don't apply to everyone or everything. They're just tendencies. The liberal mistake is to get the sign wrong. The Republican mistake, the conservative mistake, is to get the magnitude wrong. I'll explain what I mean by that. With the liberal, the temptation is to think that all good things go together, that there aren't any trade-offs at all. You see that in the idea that the best way to deal with climate change is to invest in green technologies that'll create more green jobs, increase economic growth, and slow carbon emissions. Or the best thing during a pandemic is to have restrictions on activity, because that won't just save lives, it also, by saving lives, will help the economy. And that all of these good things go together. And that's what I mean by getting the sign wrong. Not that it's never the case that all good things go together. I can think of a number of examples where you can do things that both help the economy and help climate change. But an awful lot of what you'd want to do on climate change, you're doing not because you want more economic growth, but because you want less emissions. And they're not things you would have done in a world where carbon dioxide was a completely harmless gas. So that's what I mean by getting the sign wrong on the trade-off. What's the consequence of this? Well, if you applied this philosophy rigorously and analytically carefully, you'd end up doing too little. You shouldn't just combine your interventions to things that advance, let's say you have just two goals, to things that advance both of your goals simultaneously. Everything that advances both goals, you should do. If you care about inequality and growth, anything that helps growth while reducing inequality, you should want to do it. But once you've done all of that, you then want to do some more things. You want to do some things where you give up a tiny bit of growth to get a big gain on your other goal, climate change, poverty, save lives, or vice versa, that you give up a little bit of lives, a little bit of climate change, in order to make a huge stride forward for growth. So analytically, if you were rigorous about it, you'd end up doing too little. More common, though, the mistake is not to be rigorous about it, and instead to fool yourself into thinking that whatever you're doing is going to accomplish all your goals simultaneously. Now, if it's well-intentioned and you're setting up a wonderful program for children, a wonderful program for climate change, a wonderful program to save lives in the pandemic, you know, what's the harm of kidding yourself? And rather than talking about some side effects and unintended consequences, just saying that all good things go together. I think there are some downsides to it. One is the world really does impose some constraints on you. If you try to, for example, do a massive fiscal stimulus in an economy that's very close to its capacity, you're just not going to be able to have no trade-off between unemployment and inflation. In fact, you might end up at the wrong side of that trade-off with a lot of inflation and no real ability to budge or push the unemployment rate any lower. You might end up with a bunch of regulations to deal with climate change that themselves have a set of distributional costs that, in addition to the benefits for climate change, you want to say it's going to be more expensive to buy this microwave, to buy this car. That might be worth it, that might not be worth it, but to pretend that's not the case, you can end up inadvertently harming people. And the third problem is you may not actually be able to get what you want done if you trick yourself into thinking it benefits everyone. If you think there's no costs or no downsides to your policy, you don't expect any opposition to it. I remember one issue we worked on in the White House. One of the people working on it assured me that this new regulation we were going to have for business, that the businesses were going to actually love it because it was going to increase predictability, make their lives easier, make their lives better. And their stock price all fell 5% on the day we announced it. That doesn't make the policy bad, by the way. Our goal was not to maximize the stock price of these companies. It was to maximize social welfare. But as an input into that social welfare analysis, part of it was how it affected those companies. And I trust their shareholders' ex post evaluation of regulation more than the well-intentioned staffer who assured me that they would all love and appreciate it. So you can end up with policies that have losers. The losers aren't fooled by your happy talk. They understand they're losers. The problem isn't that they don't understand economics, it's that they do. They don't like it. And if you don't understand that and figure out compensation, you can't build a political coalition. The conservative error can be one of not getting the sign wrong on the trade-off, but getting the magnitude wrong. Thinking that whatever it is, the effects on economic growth are going to be so large that you don't need to think about anything else. If you look at the recent tax cuts in the United Kingdom that were originally proposed, I think the people proposing it, insofar as they had any analysis at all, thought it would increase economic growth so much that those tax cuts would pay for themselves. Whatever staffer assured the prime minister that that was the case, had to deal with the fact that after they were announced, financial markets disagreed and did not think that those tax cuts were going to pay for themselves. Interest rates skyrocketed. The Tax Cut and Jobs Act, Robert Barrow and I, he coming from more of the conservative side, me coming from more of the liberal side, did a paper on it together in terms of the economic impact. Originally, we thought we might set, come up to, with two different conclusions and crosswalk between our conclusions and explain why we had a different view. We ended up having the same view, so we didn't need to do that. That view was that they would add 0.2 to 0.4 percentage points to the level of output after a decade. That might be good enough to support the legislation, and for Robert, it was. In my case, that was a relatively small gain in growth, and some of the distributional and other harms, from my perspective, outweighed that, and so my judgment was against that legislation. But you could only make that judgment if you thought it was going to add, 80% to growth, then you're going to want to do it. If you think any time you raise tax cuts on a high-income household, any time you do anything for climate change, it's going to just wreck the economy and destroy it, well, then you can't really get into a cost-benefit conversation when the costs are infinite. And that is what I think, in some sense, is the conservative vice. So what's the solution to both of these? Here I'm going to talk my book and argue it's more economics education, whether that's in my class, reading the many things that many of the people in this room read, and thinking in a disciplined way about issues like budget constraints, like trade-offs, like cost benefit, and the like. What I'm concerned about is that there just seems to be less and less interest in that in the world today than there has been in the past. Well, it's always a little bit concerning when you think the past was some golden age paradise, and when you were more a part of that past than you are of the present, you probably need to check that temptation even more. But my perception is when you look at something like student loans in the United States, that not a lot of economic analysis went into the consequences of that. And insofar as it did, it focused on one half of the equation, the direct effects of the policy, who would benefit, without looking at the other half, on the indirect unintended consequences for tuition, future indebtedness, who would ultimately foot the bill, inflation, interest rates, and the like. The UK, with what they did with their recent mini budget, would be another example of where economists don't seem to have really been in the room doing the analysis, because I don't think it's that they have bad economists at the Office of Budget Responsibility in the UK. It was just they didn't want to bring them in and listen to them. And I think we have to try to understand why economists are listened to less than they should. And I'm on the record of saying I'm glad President Obama didn't listen to everything I had to say, because if he did, he wouldn't have had a second term. And if he had managed to limp along that far, it would have been a sort of disastrous one. So I think you do need to have some balance of what you can pass Congress, what people can live with, what's implementable, a whole set of considerations economists don't have. But the economic portion of it is in considerably shorter supply, or actually I think the problem is in shorter demand than almost any of those other considerations are. On the progressive side, some of this has gone under a rather explicit set of interrelated movements, some of whom support modern monetary theory, some of whom support a neo-Brandeisian approach to antitrust, all of whom hate neoliberalism. I at first didn't really know what neoliberalism was, and then eventually I realized just whatever I think is neoliberalism. That's the definition of it, and probably the same goes for some people in this room. And I've tried to think, a friend of mine asked me, what do the sort of anti-neoliberals, post-neoliberalisms sort of want to substitute in its place? They don't like cost-benefit analysis. They don't like putting a value of life. They don't like doing an antitrust analysis of the effect on consumer welfare. They don't like calculating the budget constraint. What's the sort of alternative? The charitable explanation I got from someone more sympathetic to these ideas than I am is that, this post-neoliberalism, anti-neoliberalism is sort of dedicated to the proposition of inclusive growth. We should do as many things we can to increase growth and reduce inequality at the same time. Maybe universal preschool would be an example of that. Maybe that would increase growth and reduce inequality. That's the definition I'm all in. In fact, I think in some sense, everyone's all in. Who would be against something that only had good effects and didn't have any bad effects? So I think there's some other definitions sort of that acquire some more bite. One of them is a belief that economics has overstated the importance of scarcity. In fact, that's the definition we use in our first class, scarce resources to achieve your means, scarce means to achieve your ends, and has overstated that, has overstated budget constraints, has overstated all of that. And then we need to break free of the shackles of it. I do think there have been times when those constraints have been overstated. I think when you're dealing with the financial crisis, the budget constraint around fiscal stimulus was smaller than many people thought it was. Fiscal stimulus was going to expand the size of the economy, partly pay itself back, and cost much less than you'd think it actually would. So I think there have been times and places where that's been the case, but you really need the analysis to understand what those times and places are. And if you're emerging from a natural disaster like COVID, much of which is going to solve itself through vaccination, all of which can't solve itself infinitely fast because supply chains have their constraints, the economics of doing fiscal stimulus in that environment is quite different than the economics of doing fiscal stimulus in a world of a 10% unemployment rate in the wake of a financial crisis where households are overly indebted as opposed to have very healthy balance sheets. There's a third definition that I think a lot of post-neoliberals coalesce around, and that's a really deep skepticism of markets. They don't like the way I teach economics, which is I start, as I did in class on Monday this week, with perfect competition. And then I say, here's a bunch of assumptions that go into perfect competition. No externalities, competition, information, et cetera. And then the rest of the course go through those different assumptions, talk about lots and lots of ways markets fail. But in general, in thinking about those market failures, you're sort of starting with, here's how the market works. Oh, here's something that makes it go wrong. And then in terms of policy, here's how we fix that. So if it's an externality, it's a Pigouvian tax. If it's competition, it's antitrust and the like. And there's just much more enthusiasm for much more direct regulatory approaches, whether that's price controls or anti-price gouging to control inflation, whether that's a pretty regulatory command and control approach to climate change, under the misleading argument that it's too late to use market mechanisms, using that approach on a wide scale to wages and the like. That third definition of anti-neoliberalism or post-neoliberalism is probably the aspect of it that I like least. No, I'm not a libertarian. I think because even though Jeff tried to convince me that there's such a thing as consequential libertarianism that had no philosophical difference from everyone else, I think I probably do have a somewhat different social welfare function, a little bit less of an emphasis on individual liberty, a little bit more that if we could raise the top tax rate to 90% and there were no distortions at all from it, probably wouldn't mind doing that because other people could use the money better than and would make them happier than the people that were losing the money. And the only constraint on doing that is insofar as you're ending up hurting the economy and hurting the people at the middle and the bottom, not that the person at the top had some right to a property right that I think itself was derived in some sort of uncertain and contingent way. Not here to debate this question, just describing that I'm coming from a more utilitarian perspective and less of at least a philosophical libertarian one. But I read libertarians a lot. I read libertarians avidly because almost everything that I would like to accomplish, whether it relates to poverty reduction, to climate change, or big topics like that, or small topics like bringing down the price of hearing aids, or bringing down the price of insulin, I think libertarians have an awful lot to offer. A lot of that is because of two sort of basic ideas. One is that people and businesses are sort of going to do what they're going to do. Your solution to inflation can't be that you think businesses are evil, greedy. Sorry, this talk's going to end up being about inflation. The corporations are just evil, greedy. They just do whatever they want. And by the way, don't worry about all the wage increases they're giving, because they're just going to sort of eat that in the form of lower profits, and none of that will the greedy corporations pass on in higher profits. Corporations aren't going to do what you want them to do and what you'd like them to do. They're going to sort of do what they're going to do. People are going to do what they're going to do. I don't think it's 100% self-interest in a narrow Gordon Gekko greed type of way, but it's an awful lot closer to that than thinking everyone's going to go out and act to try to create the type of world you want. And when you're designing public policy, you have to take that as given. The second thing, and on this topic, I actually probably have more expertise than almost anyone that works at Cato, not to rub it in or anything. I think the government has often really, really limited capacity to understand problems and craft really elaborate, creative solutions to them. I don't think any of you were particularly surprised by that. You've all been writing about it for a long time, but you've lived it a lot less than I have. And you know, sometimes I'd be in a room where there was literally like a mathematical identity that people were arguing with. There would be something like in health insurance, we agreed on, the Affordable Care Act would have a certain coverage ratio that at least, you know, no more than 30% of your costs could be out of pocket. And then people would say, okay, now that we have that, you know, let's have a lower deductible. And I'd say, well, if you have a lower deductible, you know, you get higher coinsurance. And they'd be like, oh, no, let's have lower coinsurance. And I'd say, no, you know, once you set that other variable, these other two are just a function of it. So you can pick two of the variables. You can't pick all three of them independently when they have to add up. Those were the sort of less on that particular topic, the less, erudite ones. On that particular one, when we were trying to decide this question of, you know, what should the deductibles be? What should the rules on deductibles be? I sat down with a friend of mine who's a colleague now, and we thought long and hard about it for like an hour straight and couldn't decide what we thought was in people's best interest. We just weren't sure, and we were pretty educated and pretty good at it. To me, that said, you know what, we probably just shouldn't put that in a regulation, put that in a law, make it last forever. Maybe people have different tastes, different interests. They might know things that we don't know. And I think we were on the better end of the spectrum because at least we understood, you know, how to do arithmetic with three numbers. So those two insights, that people and businesses are going to sort of do what they're going to do, and that the government, I think, does have a limited ability, lead me to a worldview that if I could pick the way we did public policy, it would place markets front and center. It would use them as much as possible to solve almost everything you could, but would recognize, first of all, they can't do all of that on their own. I'll talk about what that means in a moment. Second, they're not going to solve every one of those different goals I began with all on their own, because not every one of those goals is demanded by consumers. And they're not going to result in the income distribution I want. And so you're going to need potentially a lot of redistribution at the end of that. So this is sort of roughly a second fundamental welfare theorem economics view of the world of change the endowments and then let the markets work. So letting the markets work, in part, that means not having anti-price gouging rules and not having rules on who can sell insulin and not having rules on, you know, who can sell hearing aids, not having the Jones Act, not having, I thought that'd be an applause line, not having tariffs, not having quotas, you know, all these different things where you're sort of micro trying to handle one part of the market. So a lot of it means getting rid of a lot of that regulation. In fact, I think a competition agenda, which I've been very much in favor of and beating the drum for and for some time, a non-trivial portion of a pro-competition agenda is getting in the way of what's diminishing competition, which in many sectors isn't the big evil monopolists, it's the government, either well-intentioned or poorly intentioned, through the types of things I just said, or restrictions on occupational licensing, restrictions on land use, and the like. So to make markets function, you have to sort of get rid of all those things so you can have more competition, so they can do things they're supposed to do. But they need a lot of inputs. One input they need is people. The more immigration, the better. I thought at least Brian Kaplan would applaud that one. They need education. They need basic research. All of that, I think, is an important set of inputs into making those markets function. And then the markets may not have exactly the set of goals. Markets on their own don't take into account that my carbon emissions affect someone else, affect people in the future. And so harnessing the genius of, you know, hundreds of millions of people as they make their choices, of millions of businesses as they figure out how to innovate and what they do, by sending them the right signal through something like a carbon tax instead of a decent amount of the regulations we have now, and with the money returned to households in the form of a dividend, would be the best way to tackle a problem like that. As I said, I don't have any reason to think this system would result in a distribution of income that I'd be happy with a level of poverty that I'd be happy with something that I think would maximize a utilitarian social welfare function. So the other part of this would be the redistribution to ensure that the people sort of join in and benefit from this. But there too, it's not like you have to take off all that economic analysis, the cost benefits, the trade-offs I was talking about before. Ideally, you'd design it as well as possible. So I've written on the corporate tax side, raising the corporate tax rate and having expensing and disallowing interest deductions. I think on the individual side, for any given level of capital taxation, I'd rather do it in a less distortionary manner, which actually means either taxing capital gains at death, or if you can figure out administratively how to do it mark to market, you get less capital lock-in, and then one can debate, you know, what the right level of capital taxation is. Another one is more broad-based taxation. And the very first one that I'd start with and be most enthusiastic about, which has left the political debate entirely, and there's a bipartisan consensus that it's a horrible idea, would be to address the health exclusion, which is a way to raise money in a way that I think would increase some consciousness of costs in healthcare, lead to better insurance plans, and result in people having more money and a little bit less health coverage, such that at the margin, that trade-off, that constraint they were having was being handled in a better way. The other end of the spectrum is, what are you doing with the money? Frankly, wouldn't mind a European-style social welfare state where if you had broad-based taxation, you could support broad-based benefits as well, but I don't think that's necessary. And in the United States, I don't think we can have broad-based taxation. And so any aspiration for policy to be essential, for benefits to be universal, either means it's going to be quite small, or it's just not going to add up and leave us with bigger problems in the future. So I think you unfortunately or fortunately need to target. The more you can do cash rather than in kind, I think that's generally better. The value of a dollar to someone is a dollar. The value of anything else in kind, maybe you're lucky and you figure out the exact right, wonderful, amazing policy, but I think more likely you'll end up messing it up and the benefits of your whatever you did get captured by whatever it is. So I was more enthusiastic about the child tax credit, which I think has a hard time going wrong, than I was about the child care proposal, which could potentially have all sorts of the unintended consequences I was talking about before. Wouldn't personally go all the way to a universal basic income, because I think some targeting does make sense, giving more money to people to provide insurance when they're unemployed than when they're not, more money to someone who's disabled and unable to work than someone who's not, more money to people with larger families than the opposite too. This, not saying, this isn't a complete list of, you know, my views on policy, a complete list of what we should do on policy. I certainly don't expect anyone to have changed their value orientation based on anything I said. But there's an awful lot of the policies I just said that even if you are coming from a different value orientation, as long as you're still sort of agree on like arithmetic, and that if you have three numbers with a mathematical relationship, you can't pick all three of them independently, I think you can make an awful lot of progress. A number of these debates can be unbundled. How to tax capital can be unbundled from the question of how much to tax capital. You know, how much redistribution to do can be unbundled from the question of what is the best way to do that redistribution, and figuring out where there are genuine shared goals, of which, of all the ones I said, I think growth is the least controversial, and the one most people are in favor of is probably another one, or a case where doing this type of careful case-by-case, thinking about trade-offs, thinking about unintended consequences, doing the cost-benefit, I think could make a real difference. Just have to figure out how to both continuing to increase the supply of it, but right now it does seem to be an excess supply. Most white papers are sold for a price of zero, and so it's also figuring out how to address the demand side, and I'm sure the next panel will know exactly how to do that. Thank you. Okay. I'll stay here.
We have 15 minutes for questions. If you will raise your hand, I guess I'll call on people. So I'll start over here on my right. Is there someone coming around with a microphone?
I have a prediction.
It works much better for the video capture if we actually get you on a mic. So,
right there.
Gentleman with his hand up.
I think, okay,
there you go.
Here we go. Alrighty. Thank you for your talk. Definitely happy to see more of your kind than the AOC, for example. But I was following a lot of your talk, but at some point I saw some confusion about how the government works. And for example, you were talking about maybe using the populist genius to put in some direction for the money being spent by the governments, right? But we are not having referendums over each policy being made or each executive function being made. When you take money from one person, put it in the government's budget, and the government makes a decision for that, that is actually the few people, or nowadays, by executive branches orders, only one person that makes a decision over the judgment of the others, right? So it's not the genius of the public. It is not the genius of 100 million people. It is you putting one person's judgment over everyone else's, right? For example, you said it is better to give more money to people who have bigger families. Well, having a bigger family is a choice. Maybe I don't want to have children. Why should part of my tax, right, go to someone who wanted to have 10 kids, right? So that is exactly putting your own judgments over mine and everyone else's. And as Milton Friedman has said, assuming one's judgment over the others is not very, very different from having a dictatorship. We're just doing it small parts by small parts and kind of fooling ourselves in how the government works.
Okay,
thank you.
So probably don't agree on every topic, which is great. The unleashing the genius of 100 million people was talking about something like a carbon tax, which says you're now going to go figure out what you can do about carbon. The government does one simple thing there, and then it sends everyone off to figure it out, as opposed to the government deciding, here's what we're going to do on nuclear, here's what we're going to do on solar, here's what we're going to do on wind, and here's what we're going to do on microwave ovens. On government spending, you know, we're in a democracy. People have chosen these policies. I think it would be dictatorship to say people can't be elected and do these policies. Now, you can think the policies are a bad idea. I don't love every outcome of democracy either, but I wouldn't say it's undemocratic or a dictatorship just to have taxes and government spending. I look at government spending on education, science, infrastructure, not to mention, you know, the rule of law, defense, and the like. And on balance, I think it's pretty good. I think it could be improved on. I think it also in some cases is inadequate and lacking. The returns to basic research, I think, are very, very high, and we do too little of it. K through 12, I think, can be improved with reforms to how we pay teachers. But preschool, I don't think we can do much more of it without putting more money into it. So I think I have a different judgment than you. Mine comes, as I said, more from a utilitarian perspective. And ultimately, yeah, I think it's a legitimate choice for the government to make. And I'd like to see them make better choices, but that choice isn't presumptively to do nothing.
Other questions? Gentleman over here.
Well, I already have the mic, actually.
No. Oh, okay. Go ahead, Brian.
So Jason, when you were actually working in with policymakers, did you ever even try saying, let's get rid of all this regulation and have a Bogovian tax instead? And if you thought that was pointless, what did you learn from the fact that you were from that realization?
My view is that to be a policy advisor, and this was the way President Obama functioned. I mean, I had all sorts of insights for him on like what could and couldn't pass Congress. And he had like no interest in my insights. And I was sort of offended by that. But then the congressional staffer had all sorts of insights about the economic consequences of different tax policies. And President Obama had as much interest in that person's view of analysis of economics as he did in my view of legislation. And I thought that deal was sort of okay and worked out for me. I thought your job was basically to say this option's 10, you know, it'd be amazing. This option's 7, this option's 3, and this option is -5. And then the legislative advisor's job, if it was legislation, was to put probabilities on the 10, I can't remember what numbers I just said, and the president's job was to multiply and decide which one was highest and do that. I'm not sure he saw his job that way, and obviously that's a flippant and unfair joke. But but I think you needed to go in and say. And so, yeah, if in every meeting you just said a carbon tax is better than this, it just wasn't that useful. President Obama understood a carbon tax was a great policy. I think most everyone in the West Wing of our White House thought it was a great policy. I don't know what they think in this White House. I do think in Democratic circles, there's less enthusiasm for a carbon tax, even sort of blue sky, you could do anything, than there used to be. And so what I sort of want from people is not that they necessarily do the perfect thing every time, but they at least sort of know what the perfect thing is and have it in their head so that if there's an opportunity, they'll figure out how to do it. There were some times where President Obama would pick the option that was less politically palatable and surprise me, wanting to take on the fight. There were other times where, you know, if one option was 10 and one option was 4, he'd pick the 4 because he thought it could get it done or the 10 wasn't worth the fight. And as long as I sort of armed him with that information, and by the way, he didn't necessarily agree with my 10 and 4. He might change those numbers and have his own views about how the policy worked, often did. I felt I did my job.
The gentleman over here in a blue cap, could you just raise your hand a little higher so they...
But I think your job, Brian, is different. I mean, your job is to write books with big ideas that are going to change things over a longer period of time. I think you need to have that project, but also have the
how
to get the next thing done, too.
My name is Tamar Chatterjee, Save Foundation. It's interesting to hear a person from Kennedy School of Government take this kind of position that you've just described. It's very interesting. So is it like before the midterm that you're taking kind of balanced on both the conservatives and the liberals, because generally the Kennedy School of Government has been more liberal than conservative. And just one quick, your mention of masking requirement, I had a comment that I found that native-born women were very comfortable with masking requirements, double maskings, triple masking, and so on, as much as like almost going back to the Islamic burqa, and somehow they're very comfortable. So yet Governor Youngkin was able to give a clarion call and win the election. So could you tell us what's going on here?
So if you think my sympathies are exactly straight down the middle, you probably misunderstood me. And you know, they're more on one side than the other side, and I'm very comfortable with that. I tried to explain a little bit about why that is. I think I might distinguish between the ends and the means, and there's a set of ends that I think probably the Democratic Party has in a more passionate way than the Republican Party has that I agree with. And then there's the question of what the best means to those ends are, and those are two different questions, and the means might be where I differ more. In terms of this, I think I'm reasonably confident. I would have given roughly the same talk 2 years ago, probably less discussion of inflation, and would do the same talk 2 years from now.
There's a hand up right in front of you, Heather.
Yeah. And not just because those were all the same proximity to an election.
Yeah. John.
Hi, my name is Mark. Thanks a lot. I have a quick question. What's your views on the macro, specifically the outstanding debt right now of the United States? I think it's around $31 trillion I saw yesterday. Are we getting stuck or getting more and more constrained? You talked about constraints, I mean, obvious economic constraints. What are your views on that, and how much further do we have to go or not go, particularly with rates rising and the interest expense component becoming a bigger part of the budget?
Yep. So I've put forward with Larry Summers a sort of rough rule of thumb that you should focus on real debt service and want it to be below 2% of GDP and not, you know, trending up rapidly, you know, even if it's below 2% of GDP. We are much, much closer to hitting that warning sign now than we were when we first wrote that paper. In part, that's because debt has gone up, and in part, it's because and in larger part, it's because real interest rates have gone up. There's a question as to, you know, what do we forecast real interest rates to be a decade from now? One view is real interest rates were low 3 years ago because of demography and inequality and productivity and other things. None of that's really changed. We have somewhat more debt, and that's going to drive real interest rates up some, but, you know, there's a formula that lets you do that, not a huge, huge amount. And once we get through this episode, real interest rates will come down. I have a certain amount of sympathy for that view, but I also have a certain amount of nervousness. It's not just that real interest rates today are high. If you look at forward real interest rates, what the market bets the real interest rate will be a decade from now for money that you want over the decade after that, that's also quite high. In fact, that's even higher than where real interest rates are right now. And so at this point, you know, 2 years ago, I thought the main fiscal adjustment we needed to make was when the tax cuts expired, let them expire or pay for them with tax reform, and that we needed to reform Social Security. Within Social Security, we could argue about taxes and benefits, and that was sufficient, and we could take our time doing it. Now I would say, first of all, sooner is better, if only for inflation and helping the Fed, and that we may need to do more than that, and at the very least draw the line sort of in quite a strong way against anything that is digging the hole deeper.
I think we have time for one more. David Bowes.
Hi. I thought in the beginning of your talk, when you mentioned liberals get the sign wrong, conservatives get the magnitude wrong, you were really talking about the traditional sort of Reagan right, but maybe even libertarians there. And I wonder what thoughts you might have on what seems like a shift on among conservatives and Republicans against that Reaganite free market perspective to a more protectionist industrial policy, and even maybe pro-welfare state, as long as it's for the right people, perspective on economic policy.
Yeah, I'm agree with everything. You had a question mark at the end of it, but I sounded like maybe you had a view on this topic. And I suspect my view on this topic agrees with yours. Look, I do think the deepest, strongest, most unifying conviction on the Republican side is that tax cuts like cure all problems. There'll be Wall Street Journal editorials that say the way to deal with inflation is tax cuts because they'll expand the supply side of the economy and bring inflation down. So I think that from Reagan to the present is undiminished, which is sort of a shame because that's the part of it I like least. The part where I'm in enormous amounts of sympathy is the free trade part, the immigration part. And look, in our 8 years in office, we watched that slipping away. We had Paul Ryan say he wanted to work with us on immigration reform. I 100% believe he did. He didn't, I think, as his people. He couldn't bring them along. We had some political person in the White House in 2014, I think, tell us on TPP, the Republican voters are turning against trade. But don't worry, before their members of Congress figure it out, we're going to get TPP passed. Donald Trump figured it out a little bit ahead of schedule, and we didn't get TPP passed. So I think, yeah, the idea that, sort of markets is one that there is less of a constituency for now than there was in the past. And hopefully Doug Holtz-Eakin will lament that even more than I did on the Republican side.
So we actually have time for one more short question. Gentleman over here.
Thanks for a great speech. I think you'll agree, and everyone in the room will agree, the Biden administration has paid a pretty high, or we've all paid a high price for the Biden administration not taking kind of economic advice seriously enough in its early months. I wondered if you could give us a sense of, or your view on whether that's changed since then, what your sense of the administration is now in terms of whether it's learned from those lessons, whether it's listening to economists more than it used to, anything on that front?
Yeah, so there's things they've done that I strongly agree with and supported, like the Inflation Reduction Act. Wasn't the perfect way to deal with climate change, but I think it was better than nothing and probably the best they could do under the constraints. I think the IRS enforcement revenue there was just about the best thing you could do on tax policy. And the corporate minimum tax was slightly better than doing nothing on corporate taxes, but probably more in the 12th best than the first best when it comes to corporate taxes. So there's a bunch of things I like. There's a bunch of things I don't like. I've made no secret of my views on student loans and no secret of my views on the American Rescue Plan, although I regret that I'm clearer about it now than I was at the time when I spoke less clearly about those views, but still tried to get them across. Administrations always are debates between different people and who they want to listen to and what they want to do. Insofar as inflation continues to be a problem, it would say, hey, let's look at tariffs. Let's look at the Jones Act. Let's look at a lot of these regulations. Some of that's happened, less of it than I'd like, but I think those issues are hopefully live discussions and maybe inflation will unlock a few wins in some of those spaces, but we'll see.
I'm afraid we have to cut it off there, but thank you, Jason, very much. Thank you very much. That's great.